John Grogan wrote the best-selling memoir, Marley and Me, which will be out as a movie this month. Many of us read that book or heard it on Chapter a Day about the misbehaving yellow lab named Marley. Many of us recognized Marley in one of our own dogs and connected with that bond between people and our pets described in Marley and Me. Well, if you're like me, you cried at the end of Marley and Me, and you'll probably cry at the end of John Grogan's latest book, too. It's The Longest Trip Home, a memoir. Because while it is John Grogan's story of growing up and moving away and then reconnecting with his parents when they fell ill and neared the end of their lives, it's a universal story in many ways, shared by many of us right now if our parents are aging or have already passed away. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 past 8 on this Wednesday, December the 3rd. We will talk with John Grogan this hour about his journey and his memoir, The Longest Trip Home. We'll hear his story and discuss the evolving relationship between children, adult children, and their parents, and that reconciliation that can happen when a parent falls ill or passes away. We'll welcome your questions for John Grogan and your own stories, too, because I'll bet his journey will stir up your own memories. John Grogan is a journalist and a nonfiction writer. He has been a reporter, a bureau chief, a columnist for newspapers in Michigan and Florida. He has been editor-in-chief of Organic Gardening magazine. He's also a columnist, or was a columnist, for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He is the author of Marley and Me and The Longest Trip Home, a memoir. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you so much for sharing your story.
Well, it's my pleasure. I just love the whole tradition of sharing stories and connecting with people through words.
Yeah, well, I've got my box of Kleenex handy for this hour. It was very, very touching. I've already mentioned at the top of the hour that You lost your father. Your father died around Christmas time. When? A few years ago.
Yes, it was Christmas of 2004, and in fact, leading right up to Christmas. It was just a couple of days before.
Yeah, and in fact, we played a little clip of White Christmas because your mother was singing White Christmas to you just a short time before that happened.
Right, it was one of those very bittersweet things that I think all of us as adult children either have gone through or know we're going to go through at some point with our parents, where, you know, they'd been living independently in the house that I grew up in, the house that they had been in for, you know, 50 years, 45 years, and doing quite well at that. And then, but, you know, at that age, they were in their late 80s, you know, just one little thing goes wrong and the whole house of cards can come falling down. And in their case, you know, my mom had been in failing health, but my dad was the rock of Gibraltar who was keeping everything going, and he was her caretaker and keeping that whole lifestyle in place. But then when he got sick, it quickly began to unravel, and that's when we as their children had to come racing back to try to help stabilize the situation.
Yeah, thus the longest trip home?
Yes, actually the longest trip home, the title, it works on a couple of levels. In the most immediate sense, my longest trip home was this trip I made back to see my dad after I got that fateful phone call where I found out that he had leukemia. And the doctors, you know, were going to watch it and see what they could do, but they just weren't sure. We're still trying to be optimistic. And I'd been debating, like, well, maybe I'll go home in the spring, or, you know, maybe it'll be more appropriate to go home after the holidays. But I finally just woke up one day and said, you know what, I got to get home. I mean, if I want to say these things that I know I need to say to my dad, these issues that have been simmering between us for many, many years, I shouldn't wait. And it gives, you know, as I think others know who have been through this, if you wait, sometimes you wait one day too long, and then your opportunity has been lost forever.
Yeah.
So I made that trip home over Thanksgiving of 2004. My dad had been in the hospital, but he was home again just for a week or so, and we didn't know, but then he would go back in again. And it was just me and alone. I didn't bring my wife or kids with me. And we had this really wonderful weekend of reconnecting and reconciling some of these issues that had been simmering between us.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about some of those issues. One of them was that you were raised in a very devout Catholic family, and you didn't necessarily share that devotion.
Well, right. I mean, I think, you know, every family has its issues. And my family was a very warm and loving family. I joke that, you know, there's almost an expectation out there that if you write a memoir, it has to be filled with abuse and depression and anorexia and every dysfunction you can think of. But I actually grew up in a very happy home with very loving parents. They loved each other tremendously. They loved God more than anything, and they loved their children with everything they had. But what our issue was my parents were extremely devout Catholics. I mean, comically. So a lot of the scenes in the book are actually funny scenes of this kind of over-the-top Catholic family, you know, with rosaries hanging from the bedpost and holy water in the medicine cabinet and all those accoutrements of the sort of traditional faith. But as their son growing up, you know, it was the 1960s, and then into my teenage years, the early 70s, and, you know, as you know, that time of tremendous social upheaval and questioning of authority and rejection of the establishment values. So I was being pulled by that culture, and my parents were still deeply rooted in their very traditional culture. So that created a dynamic that was at once funny but often painful as well as I tried to find my place in the world where I could be true to myself but also be respectful of my parents' values.
Yeah, and you met and eventually married a wonderful woman, but she was not Catholic. She wasn't really religious at all.
That's right. In fact, anyone who's read Marley and Me knows this woman. It's Jenny, it's the woman I went on to marry, and she's a major character in Marley and Me as well. Up until the point where I met her, which was in my mid-20s, I had really been trying to balance this line, which I think a lot of kids of religious parents, whether they're Catholic or Jewish or whatever, try to do, where we're trying to be ourselves and live our own lives and follow our own moral compass, but we don't want to disappoint our parents or face the expectations that are the failed expectations. So I was kind of living this double life with them when it came to their values and religion and social issues that they had strong opinions on. I was doing my thing and living independently, but I was still kind of fudging with them the fact that I was not a practicing Catholic anymore, and I wasn't going to church, and I wasn't really buying into a lot of what they believed in so fervently.
And
then Jenny comes along, and she's got this totally outside perspective, and she grew up in a family that wasn't religious, as you said. And she was, you know, she was like my sounding board and my wake-up call. And she was like, you know, so what's going on with you here? You know, you're 26 years old, and when your parents call on Sunday afternoon, you're still lying to them about going to Mass, you know, Sunday mornings. And, you know, it was comical, but at the same time, it was, you know, as for a young man, it was kind of my wake-up call. Like, you know what, this has been going on too long. It was one thing to do it when you're a kid living under their roof, but I had never made that break. With her at my side, and I describe it in the book, there was these sort of series of episodes where the truth of my situation came. I told my parents.
Yeah, why don't you tell the story about when you called your parents to notify them that you were moving in with Jenny. Not getting married, moving
in. Right, well, that was the first big blow to their the sort of fantasy they had about their good Catholic son. I think they really led themselves to believe that I had just never had anything more than just a sort of platonic dating relationships.
You were a 30-year-old virgin.
And, right, basically, I was a 30-year-old virgin, and so Jenny and I are, you know, we're in love, and we're living. We both had gotten jobs down in Florida. We're from Michigan. We were working in Western Michigan, right across the lake from you there in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And we get jobs down in Florida, where we knew no one. We're living in two apartments, 20 minutes apart, and it just seemed right to move in together, and we knew we were committed to each other. But I kept telling Jenny, like, oh, yeah, my parents are going to be cool with it. They're going to be fine. You know, you just worry about your folks. But at the same time, inside of me, I was like thinking, like, oh, no, you know, this is, I was nervous about it. And so we waited until we got the, both of our apartments were loaded on the truck. All our combined stuff was in one truck on the way to this little rental house we just, we were going to move into. And that's when I called them. And it was one of those conversations where, you know, it felt like I knocked the wind out of them. And, you know, there was this sort of stunned silence for a few seconds. And then they just started in. They really were making a strong pitch that this was a mistake. It was, you know, it was dooming the relationship. You know, a future marriage would be doomed by starting out this way, by living in a state of sin, as they saw it. So, yeah, it was kind of a downer way to begin this brand-new life together. Mm-hmm. And that kind of set the stage for, you know, kind of hypersensitivity on all sides. You know, for the next many years, even through marriage and having our own babies and, you know, raising kids, there was this sort of, you know, we just delicately danced around this whole issue of our lifestyle choices compared to theirs. Even though, you know, in my mind, you know, I was certainly proud of myself and the life I was leading. And I described it in the book as not only was I trying to lead a moral life, but if I looked at it objectively, it was a kind of a boring life. You know, I wasn't exactly like some wild swinger out there on the street, you know.
Right.
But again, you know, there was this tension and conflict between their values and my values.
And indeed, even when your father was dying, you would talk about these issues, like the fact that you didn't raise your children in the Catholic Church either, and you had a pretty touching conversation about that.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, as the years went by, as we sort of marched, as I marched into middle age and they into their sunset years, we kind of reached this detente where we kept all our conversations on easy things, you know, the children, the weather, my job, you know, the house. But it was just this unspoken thing. It was like an elephant in the room that we all danced around. And when my dad was in the hospital in the last couple weeks, you know, I was every day going, I was home again to be there with him. And I'd spend every day with him. And one day he reached his hand out, and you know, my dad was one of these stoic men of the World War II generation. He didn't hug, didn't say I love you, didn't hold hands certainly. And he put his hand out and he took my hand in his, and he squeezed my hand. And he said, this is a good time to talk about some things. And his big concern was how the children, his grandchildren, were being raised. And he was concerned that they weren't being exposed to the faith, the Catholic faith. All of them were baptized Catholic. But, you know, just as we were going forward in life, I was figuring out that I really needed to be true to my own values. And so we had this conversation. And I think he came to respect where I was coming from. I wasn't rejecting his values based out of laziness or just too much effort or not being a thoughtful process. It really was quite the opposite, that I'd really put a lot of emotional energy into trying to figure it out and figure out where I was meant to be in the world and what my place was and how could I be true to myself. The one thing my dad and I did agree on, you know, one of the things that irked him the most were what he called cafeteria Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
People, mostly of my generation, who still called themselves Catholics, but kind of pick and chose off the menu of things they chose to believe or chose to follow and not. And his position was, you know, you're not really a Catholic if you're doing this. You know, it's a religion of hierarchy and these strong rules. And I agreed with that. And to be true to myself, I wasn't going to sit there and pretend to go through the motions if I wasn't buying into so much of it.
Yeah, but it seemed to me that you did, you did come to some sort of reconciliation. He was assured that he knew you were doing your best.
Yes, mm-hmm. And that I was really working hard to mm-hmm. raise my kids with faith and with mm-hmm. a sense of spiritualism, and a strong moral code, and I remember he said he acknowledged that, and he said, you know, it meant a lot to me. He said, you're a great father. You're doing a great job with the kids. He said, I just worry that you're depriving them of this yeah. great gift. He just saw the Catholic faith as this wondrous thing that could make your life and your whole eternity just such a superior experience yeah. to the alternative. So we did reach that that position where we both felt comfortable, mm-hmm. and it was so important, that the title of the book, for me to make that longest trip home. Specifically at the end of his life, but also that long trip from childhood into adulthood where I had to kind of bump my way and find my way. I would hate to think of me sitting here today with my dad gone and not having sort of worked these things out with him.
We are talking with John Grogan. He is a journalist, a nonfiction writer. He is the author of Marley and Me. You've no doubt heard about Marley and Me. He's also the author of The Longest Trip Home, a memoir, talking about growing up in a home in a Detroit suburb, a very devout Catholic family, moving on, moving away, breaking away somewhat from his parents' values and making a life of his own, and then the reconciliation that took place when his father died a few years ago. Talking about that longest trip home, maybe you have a similar story or a question for him. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Teach your children well, their fathers have.
This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. According to Ben's guest after 5, baby boomers have invented a new phase of life called Encore. It means not only working past retirement for more income, but for the promise of doing work that matters. Talking about the Encore career coming up after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking with best-selling author John Grogan. He is the author of Marley and Me, which is coming out as a movie, I think, this month, and also the author of his memoir, The Longest Trip Home. We welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm going to go to the phones in just a moment, John Grogan. But it was a delight reading about your growing up years in the Detroit suburb area. You're a baby boomer, right?
I am. I was born in 1957.
Yeah,
which means that I was really coming of age right at the same time that all the societal change was taking place in the '60s. 1967 was a big year for me. I was 10. Sergeant Pepper came out, the Beatles classic album. All the Detroit riots mm-hmm. were taking place. In fact, I write a chapter in the book about my uncle, who was a Catholic priest, bringing like a car full of kids from his inner city parish in Detroit out to our house, which was out in a suburb, out on a lake outside of Detroit, to ride out the riots because their whole neighborhood was being burned down and there was sniper fire. And that was really one of my first eye-opening experiences as a child, that not everyone grew up with the kind of privilege that I had around me.
Yeah, that it reminded me too. My husband grew up spent high school years in a Detroit suburb too, and talks about that same memory that you have. So you're about the same age, and grew up in that same area. What I was referring to too is that here you are in this Catholic family, and I think everybody did this. You were a little bit of a hellion, causing fireworks fires and smoking cigarettes behind the garage and the whole thing, right?
Yeah, I think it was actually one of the early chapters of the book. There's three of my best friends. We had this little gang that we ran in. And I just reconnected with one of those guys, and he said to me, I'm not making any apologies for it. It was the 1960s, for God's sake.
That's right.
I mean, it was kind of like the culture. Yeah, I mean, I became an altar boy, and the big event of being an altar boy was we figured out how to sneak the sacramental wine after the service, and we'd pass the cruet around and get a little buzz going before we went into school that morning. It was just kind of the rites of passage that I think a lot of kids of this generation went through.
And your parents really didn't know that you were causing all this havoc.
No, mm-hmm. sort of a life pattern for me was doing these things, sort of leading my own life, but taking extraordinary steps to protect them from it. And, I deny, and kind of cover my tracks pretty well.
Yeah. You lied in your first confession.
I did. I was 7 years old, and the nuns spent weeks preparing us for. I was at this Catholic school and taught by nuns. They were preparing us for this great sacrament. That's this wonderful opportunity to cleanse your soul of all your sins that a second grader is going to have. But I was convinced I had this horrible, horrible sin that I just could not divulge without deep humiliation and probably, being driven from my community. It had to do with the telescope that I had asked for my birthday. I remember when I got it, I heard my mom say to my dad, our little Galileo. She was so convinced I was, going to be an astronomer.
Yeah.
But I was not aiming that telescope up at the stars. I had it aimed right over the fence at the neighbor lady who liked to sunbathe out in her backyard. it was my first crush, and I was convinced. I'd heard that, lusting after your neighbor's wife was a grave sin. I was convinced that I was guilty of this.
The central message, or one of them that I took away too, is that your parents, you're not ridiculing your parents for their beliefs or their faith or how they raised you. You think they did a great job, really.
Absolutely. I mean, it really is a memoir of love, and mm-hmm. I think if there's an underlying message, it's that family love can triumph over family differences. And mm-hmm. in our case, they were pretty profound differences, but never in this whole process, this 40-year journey that I was making, was there any... never did we just give up on each other. There was always... The whole tension was always driven by love, and my love for them to try to protect them and not hurt them, and their love for me to try to keep me on a path that they consider was certitude. I mean, they just knew in their minds was the right path. I have deep respect for their values and deep respect for how they lived their values. I mean, they really walked the talk, and they did a lot of charity work. They were very kind and generous in the community. And they really lived their values, and I respected that deeply.
Yeah, and one of at least your mother's big concerns, though, is that she thought she might have failed as a parent because she didn't instill this, this deep Catholic faith in you.
Yeah, I think she was trying to figure out, and my father too, where they went wrong. It's mm-hmm. like they tried so hard to do everything right to raise good Catholic children. And in their minds, that was the most important role they had as parents on this earth, was to make sure that their children, the next generation, would carry this faith forward. And especially, certainly with me, but also with my other three siblings to varying degrees, they could see that wasn't working. And they did consider it a failing. Like, you know, what did we do wrong? What could we have done differently? You know, they sent us to Catholic schools. They, you know, absolute mandate that you went to Mass every Sunday and certainly as many weekdays as possible. And we were altar boys. We were servers. We were involved in the Catholic youth groups. You know, they went through all the steps, and there was, and really, they made no compromises on the faith with us. It was, there was, the word certitude is what keeps coming to me. They just had this conviction, and they stuck with it. And despite all that, or maybe because of it, you know, I wasn't buying into it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take some calls. We have many waiting to talk with you. Rich and Sullivan is with us now. Hi, Rich, you're on the air.
Thank you. Mr. Grogan, John, I just want to talk briefly about an earlier book of yours, although I will get this one. There's a compilation of your columns to the Philadelphia Inquirer, I think it is.
Right.
Titled Bad Dogs Have More Fun. And I was just out in California visiting my sister and her disabled husband. They were in a car accident 3 years ago, and she walked away from it unscathed, but Doug is now blind and bedridden and traumatically brain damaged. He speaks.
No.
But the whole point is, sometimes when I'm around him, because I only see him infrequently, I try to figure out what to do or what to talk about, you know, stuff like that, other than reading the sports pages, which he likes to hear read still. And I picked up your book at a independent bookstore. I got to get that in, not at a big box store, but at
okay.
an independent bookstore in their community in the East Bay of San Francisco. And I read several pieces to him. I think the first one is about Caitlin Reed or someone like that. It says, I think it's Deaf Girl Provides Lesson and Courage.
Right.
And then there was also one about a tow truck driver who did save this woman's life, and then by simply going off his route and getting the family to the hospital. And then he was unidentified. Well, and then in the next piece, you identify who he was. People found out who he was. And I just want to say that that writing is so powerful that it really made a difference. It made a difference not only to my brother-in-law, who listens very well but has trouble communicating back rapidly, at least. And I wanted to recommend that book. Of course, I've read Marley and Me. And I'm interested in this next book. But I thought you might want to hear that someone had taken the book with the short pieces, which are 5 to 7 minutes to read. They're just perfect.
And those are my old newspaper columns from when I worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And the newspaper, after I left and, you know, sort of a known name now around the country, they went and packaged those together. And so that's what you were reading, was my Philadelphia Inquirer columns.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. You know, this, as a columnist, that was my great hope, that you never quite know each day how your column would hit, but that they would somehow touch people and change their day just a little bit.
Yeah. How's your mom doing, John? She's
my mom's still going strong. Mm-hmm. She's 92 years old. Lives in a nursing home. It's a nursing home that my dad sort of had hand selected for her when he saw the writing on the wall and knew that he wasn't going to be there to care for her. She's suffering, as I describe in the book, from kind of early to mid stages Alzheimer's. She's basically, her short term memory's not good. But she recognizes and remembers all of us, and she has this amazing memory for her childhood and my childhood. So she's always been a great storyteller. I think if I have any gift for it, I got it from her. And she still loves to tell stories, and I'm always amazed at her memory. She'll remember the color of the blazer I wore at my eighth grade graduation.
Wow.
You know, but she doesn't know what she had for lunch yesterday.
Well, it reminded me, too. My mom had a stroke and some dementia issues as well. She has passed away quite some time ago. But I used to read to her, like Rich was talking, reading to a friend. I bet, does your mom know that you wrote this book? Does someone read it to her? Or?
She does, but no. She's kind of past the point of, like, concentrating long enough to, like, absorb like a whole chapter.
Yeah.
The book has pictures of my childhood on the inside covers, the back and front, and the first picture is her holding me as a newborn,
mm-hmm.
and then me as a toddler, and all the way up through adolescence, and then adulthood, and shows me with the kids. So I sat and showed her the pictures, and she brightens right up. You know, she is aware that I'm a nationally recognized author at this point. Like, she saw me on Good Morning America a few weeks ago, and the nurses came rushing in and said, Ruth, your son's on TV.
Mm.
And she was really proud of that.
Yeah, there's a picture of you looking rather ridiculous with really long hair playing a guitar.
Yeah, I had that classic 70s look that at the time I was convinced looked really cool.
It was cool at the time, yeah.
Huge bush of hair that looked like, you know, I had a jungle growing on my head. Mm. Big, huge aviator glasses, big bell, everything was big.
Yeah, we will. Thank you, Rich, for the call. Patty in Green Bay, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. Hi, John. We loved Marley and Me. We listened to it on our road trip from Green Bay to Mount Rushmore with our kids. And there were a couple parts we had to, you know, track forward.
Mm-hmm.
But the kids, you know, they wanted that part where Marley's, like, going out of the window at the highway.
Right.
Played over and over again. So we loved that. But
that's one of my favorite parts of the book, too.
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to have been in that car when it was happening.
Yes.
but I want to thank you for that book. And thank you for your current book, because I think we're facing similar choices with my mom. My sister and I live about 4 hours from her, and she still has her house in Madison, and she's in her late 80s, and I was driving from Madison. I drove from Green Bay to Madison and then back on Sunday, and we had a snowstorm that you probably didn't hear about, but we did, and I was in that snowstorm. I was driving home and thinking, you know, this will be the last winter she'll probably be in that house, and, you know, all of a sudden you become the grown-up for your parents, and it's quite an epiphany, and, you know, there's a lot of decisions to make, but, you know, it'll be nice to read a book of somebody else going through that same journey, you know, and my mom is very faithful, a very faithful Catholic, too, and I think we found a place for her in Green Bay that will kind of fit that bill for her, but
yeah.
I appreciate you, you know, touching the rest of us out here that are actually going through that right now. So thank you, John.
Well, thank you, Patty. And, I mean, you made a really good point when you just mentioned that, you know, I'm feeling like I'm the grown-up now. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I had that moment of epiphany, too. There was that turning point where I sort of realized, like, you know, I'm now the one who is the, I described it as the shepherd. And my parents, my aging parents, are the flock, the sheep that need to be protected and taken care of. And always up until that point, you know, there was always mom and dad to rely on to take care of any problem. Even as an adult, you know, you lose your job, you can move back in with mom and dad or whatever it is. And they were always there for us. And it's a profound moment when you go from knowing you have that safety net to knowing that now you're the safety net and it's all on your shoulders.
Yeah.
It's really just it's one of the most emotionally moving experiences, I think, of the human experience.
Absolutely. You also reassured your father when he was dying that you didn't know it for sure at the time, but that you and your siblings had found them a place at an assisted living retirement community that where, you know, you or dad and mom could go. And I think it made him, you know, he was assured by that, you know, that mom would be taken care of should he die.
Right. Yeah. You know, he was fiercely independent. I think there was nothing he feared more than losing that independence and having to go into a place, an assisted living type of a facility. But, you know, you face reality and you start making your compromises and your bargains, and he realized at a certain point that even if I can survive this leukemia, he was so weakened by the chemotherapy and the treatments that he knew that there, you know, the game was up, that there was no longer would he be able to do it all. I mean, he was still driving, he was sharp as a tack, he was doing all the grocery shopping, all the house cleaning, he was taking care of all my mother's medications, taking care of her personal needs, and that was over now. And, you know, it's I can't think of a sadder experience than to watch your parents go through that. Especially, I think most of us have parents this way who just cherish this life. They spent all this energy building this life together. And then as the adult child, you're there watching and sort of trying to help them as they have to dismantle it, and, you know, without, not by choice, but by necessity.
We are talking with John Grogan. He is the author of Marley and Me. Also, though, the author of his latest book, The Longest Trip Home, a memoir. It's about his journey through life, growing up in a Catholic home in a suburb of Detroit, and his relationship with his parents, and how that relationship evolved, and the reconciliation that happened at the end of his father's life. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Teach your parents well, their children's hell.
Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen and her guests will discuss the history, meaning, and possible future of the Fairness Doctrine. That's coming up after 9. Back to now to more of your calls for John Grogan about his memoir, The Longest Trip Home. And our next caller is Jerry in Duluth. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Joy. And John, thank you so much for spending your time with us today. I'm just really enjoying the conversation and the points that your life parallels so identical to mine with the Catholic upbringing and going to parochial school. And, you know, even till now, my mom calling and I'm still lying about not going to church on Sunday, or going to church on Sunday.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Yeah, I know, and it makes, you know, I just want to call to let you know that it makes me feel a lot better about my life, knowing that there's somebody else that's sharing the same stories. I mean, even the parallelism of, you know, my father passing away and my mom's age is 92, you know, everything that you've been talking about is just, I've just been laughing and enjoying myself with your time. So thank you so much for being there, and thank you, Joy.
Well, Jerry, thank you very much for calling. Do you think, John Grogan, that Jerry should continue to talk to Mom about going to Mass on Sunday?
Well, maybe at this point he should just let it go. You know, it's like there's that balancing act with our parents, especially as they get quite old. It's like, you know, how much do they need to know, and you know, how do you balance that out? And you know, at this point in time, maybe the kindest thing is to let her, you know, live out her years with whatever beliefs that give her comfort.
Yeah.
But you know, I loved his point about my experience reflecting his own. One of the joys I take out of being an author is hearing from people all over the world, not just Americans, who say, you know, it's like you were describing my life. I got a lot of that with Marley and Me, you know, the story of this young couple starting out in life with this crazy dog. But now I'm getting it with The Longest Trip Home. You know, people just like this caller who said, you know, God, the parallels between your life and mine, I really took a lot from that, and that means a lot to me as a writer.
Yeah. Now we'll go to Joan in Green Bay. Hi, Joan, you're on the air.
Hi. If my question is really, I'm enjoying Marley and Me, and I'm just in the process of reading it because I have a little five-month-old chocolate lab, and I'm sure I'm going to be dealing with some of those issues. It's very lovely. But my question is a little bit different from most people. I'm dealing with my children like John's parents were with him, and it worries me because they're not doing the faith that I grew up in, and they're very anti-Christian, it seems, and it's the grandchildren I worry about. Is this new book going to help me with some of the issues that his parents dealt with?
Well, I'm glad to get your question, because it's very interesting to me to, you know, and I've heard from people on the other side of the equation from my story, who are worried about their children and grandchildren growing up without the faith that you had or have. I do think that the book might be illuminating for you, because at a minimum, it'll sort of help show you the amount of emotional anguish that can take place for the kids trying to meet parental expectations. And in my case, you know, we finally kind of coming to a certain place in life where you're comfortable with yourself. But I think, you know, where your parents can respect your decisions in life. The other point I might make is that, you know, just because someone's not necessarily following the mechanics of the religion, doesn't mean that they haven't absorbed a lifetime of the spiritualism and the morals and the ethics that religious upbringing put into their lives. And I like to think that was the case with me, that even though I found, like, my the organized religion aspects were not working for me, I still see so many positive things that came out of my experience growing up in this religious home with these strong values, and I've retained those, and that's something that no one can ever take away.
Thank you, Joan. Well, now we go to Andy in Appleton. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just noticed while listening here that the last three guests all talked about being able to relate to your characters very much in your work. And I'm thinking about how that contrasts with other memoirs and other fiction that we've seen soon or recently, where it's tell all or confess all, and if you don't have it, make it up. And the reason I ask this is I'm interested in what you may think the trend of memoir and story might be. I'm reading a new story right now, a book of stories. It's called The End of the Straight and Narrow by David McGlynn. And so many of the same issues. There's the adult child going home. There's the dealing with the parent's spirituality. There's an elderly neighbor who drinks gin and won't put her clothes on. I mean, it's just... they're funny stories, they're hilarious, they're sad, and I think it's because they're true and plausible, and I think there may be a greater value in that than there is in this sensational spectacle. So I wonder if you feel there's a trend going more towards the real and the plausible and away from this sensational memoir.
Well, thank you for that question, because this is a topic that's important to me. You know, you're right. There's been pressure on memoirists to crank it up, and if it's not, if you don't have enough like outrageous things happening in your life, then it's not quite worthy of a large audience. You know, the most sort of notorious case was Million Little Pieces, or a story, but you know, the James Frey book, where you know, so much of it was fabricated, and it came back, you know, to bite him very hard. You know, I totally subscribe to a different school. I think that each of us has a story inside of us, a story worth telling, and an experience, a life experience that's relevant and that matters. If we can unlock the key to our inner self and let it out, and if we have the ability to tell a story well, I don't think you need to have this sort of parade of sort of, like you said, ugly spectacle to make a story worth reading. And, you know, most of the reviewers of my new book have been very kind, but the couple that have criticized it have been like, well, you know, nothing really horrible happened to him, so why is he spending all the time to write this book? And I just think it's just so misplaced. It's like, you know, I mean, life is life, and life is real. And as you said, some of the great charm of true stories is that they reflect the experience of many, of others. And especially if you can be insightful enough to see how those experiences link together to change people and to help us evolve as humans. I find it really meaningful and worthwhile. So I'm certainly of the belief that, you know, if it says memoir, if it's true, it better be true, mm-hmm. and it better be true to the best of your ability, and not fudge, and not sort of like juice things up. I spent my entire career up until recently working as a newspaper journalist, so, you know, that whole, you know, document things and make sure that it's accurate, not only accurate, but that the accurate facts are arranged in a way that get to the truth as close as you can. That's what I've been instilled with. And then if people find my books to be too ordinary, well, so be it. But that's the real story.
Right, they're far from ordinary. Yeah, Sigrid in Reedsburg. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make the comment that one of the things that our parents do as they die is they teach us to die and how to die. And one of the greatest gifts my father gave me was in his dying, he allowed us to talk about his death. He picked out songs he wanted at his funeral. He made sure my mother had a new car so she'd have a reliable one. And it was easy to say goodbye, and I think that I was struck by how parents continued to teach us and show us the way. And as I said, it was a great gift, and I don't know how you felt, but I think that that's something sometimes where we are so concerned about our own feelings and thoughts that we aren't listening to the person who's dying and we aren't taking the lead from them. But as I just wanted to make the comment that
I'm glad you did. We only have about a minute to go. John Grogan?
That's a really good point. I mean, and that was the case with my father, too. You know, I mean, we all die. Life is finite, and it wouldn't be precious if it weren't finite. For me, the experience was personally very sad, this great loss. But as far as the end of a life for him, it was. I used the word beautiful in my book. I mean, it really was this sort of beautiful saying goodbye and peaceful departure. And he had enough time that he lined everything up. He felt that things were under control, and he had this sense of peace. And then it was time to say goodbye, and it really was a beautiful experience.
Yeah, he wanted to say, I love you, this man who would shake your hand when you were growing up.
Right. Yeah. You know, that was, you know, that inability to really show your emotions, and I think a lot of men of his generation were like that. But he so had this deep love in him that was obvious, and we were able to tell each other we loved each other, and to have those important things said that had to be said, and then it felt right that now it's time for me to leave.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so much for sharing your memoir. It was a real pleasure to read.
It was a pleasure being on the show.
John Grogan is the author of The Longest Trip Home, a memoir. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, Rob Ferret, and Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Listen to hear sleigh bells.